Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Greg Reberg. I'm really pleased to be able to welcome back into our studios for today's program two colleagues from Carthage College, Dr. Thomas Carr, who is Associate Professor of Biology and Director of the Center of Paleontology at Carthage, and also the senior science advisor to the Dinosaur Discovery Museum here in Kenosha. And with him today, and she has joined us on a couple of previous occasions, Megan Zeitz, who is preparator. And so she serves as a really indispensable kind of field assistant out in the field in the exciting work that Dr. Carr and others do in these so-called dinosaur digs. And the most recent trip out to Montana, which is roughly the 10th year that Dr. Carr and others have been doing these dinosaur digs, yielded all kinds of exciting results. And so he's here. They both are here today to talk about this latest dinosaur dig in Montana and what might be ahead in terms of other exciting discoveries that might be on the horizon. So Dr. Thomas Carr, Megan Zeitz, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have both of you here. So, roughly 10 years or so that you have been making these trips out to Montana. So, this might be an appropriate moment to just kind of step back and get a sense of how all of this even began and sort of the scope of what you have accomplished. Where did this activity in Montana begin?
Well, for us, it started back in 2005. A very intrepid group of undergraduate students from UW-Madison were doing field work in this particular area on BLM land, on federal public land, on a couple of ranches. And they all got into graduate school and couldn't continue those activities and turned over roughly half of that area to me and the other half to the Burpee Museum, which is in Rockford, Illinois. And so I've carried the torch for, as you mentioned, roughly a decade, and our activities out there have expanded and developed over the past 10 years. We now have a more focused and somewhat formal research initiative in collaboration with Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, where we are really striving to document the rocks and the fossils in a proper geological context. We bring the paleontological expertise to the table. Wheaton brings the geological expertise. Mm. And it's we had a start at this two summers ago, and we're already starting to, you know, get some very interesting results to actually understand our area in a way that we haven't before. So Wheaton's been absolutely indispensable for that. And it's the start of a very, I think, long and productive collaboration that will benefit not only science but also students. Hmm. Part of the goal is to train students in field techniques, paleontological and geological. And so there's a tremendous opportunity there for science education, at least, you know, at the college level.
Hmm. The transaction that sort of allowed this to go forward roughly 10 years ago, are those kind of transactions commonplace in your field? That is, where somebody is doing work and then their circumstances change and it's nothing they can continue with, and it gets, in a sense, signed over to somebody else. Is that commonplace? And really, what is that? Exactly, what is that transaction? What's being, in a sense, signed over?
Right. I have to speculate that it isn't that uncommon, you know, at least with, you know, when people do field work, they either continue the work of previous groups, whether it's from the same institution or not. So these sorts of arrangements, I imagine, are not that uncommon, because we know that there are institutions that, for, you know, that have worked in particular areas for many years, and sometimes others take over. So it's not uncommon. The actual changing over isn't all that formalized. In 2005, the UW-Madison group took me around to meet the ranchers. So I collected with them, or was doing field work with them for a week. And during that time, I met the ranchers. I met the BLM agents or field managers. They already had a heads up on things would be changing hands. And so there's a formality and an informality. And I think at the bottom of it, the crew that's moving on wants to find an institution or an individual that they trust, that they have an understanding of a shared interest in terms of continuing that work. And they, I guess, sized me up in the burpee according to those criteria, that we would have a long-standing commitment that would be to the benefit of not only the science students, but also the area. Mm-hmm. You know, that we would operate there ethically and would be cooperative with the local community.
Right. Maybe you could say a quick word about the land on which these dinosaur digs has taken place over the years, and in a sense, what kind of permission you or whoever has to secure in order to be permitted to be there.
Right. In our area, the lands, if you look at a map, is a patchwork of private, state, and federal land. And the federal lands that we collect on are mostly contiguous sections of land. There's a couple patches separate from the main, you know, the main area that we're at. We have to apply for permits from the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, and we do that each year. We submit a report, a formal field report, so there is the level of formality there. We have to provide maps and forms for each of the major localities that we have, and I really do appreciate and enjoy that level of transparency. So I think in terms of demonstrating the ethics of the science to students, I think that when they, you know, they have to gather that information on the field when we're out there, and that all goes into the field report, like, say, coordinates for where we find a fossil, that sort of thing. They see the field report during class for various exercises. So we have to, you know, submit this report. We meet with the field agents before we head out into the field in Montana. So we have to go out to Miles City and meet with the field manager and get the permit signed. And we chat for a while about how field work is going, whether we've seen any illicit activity, which is unfortunately is not uncommon in the area. There are fossil poachers that will poach on, you know, any land, doesn't matter if it's private or federal or state, and we disclose what we've seen. We're in a pretty remote area, so we don't see much of that, but it does happen. And we also have to maintain our relationships with the ranchers. So there's a social aspect to this as well, in an interaction with the local community. And the most significant institution out there is the Carter County Museum. And each summer they host, for the past several years, have hosted something called the Dino Shindig. So there's a day of public talks given by professional scientists and BLM managers. And so I've given a talk at the Shindig every year, and we actually center or schedule our field work around the Shindig because it's such a positive experience for the public. It's a tremendous public education initiative, and many institutions are involved. So it's us, the CCM, the Burpee, and other institutions like the Smithsonian actually are regular presence there as well. And so it's very, that aspect of what we do is quite important in terms of science education, public education, and contributing to the local community, which is in Egalaca, Montana.
Wow. By the way, this is probably the maybe the dumbest question I'm going to ask you today, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So is the main reason you do this out in Montana because we're talking about, in a sense, largely untouched land, we're not covered by concrete parking lots? Or is it that there are so many dinosaur remains out there? I mean, like if this wasn't such a developed urban area, I mean, are there Triceratops remains underneath this building, but we just can't get to them? Or is it that there's are many, many more specimens to be found in a place like Montana, and it's also untouched, so those fossils still exist or are accessible?
Yeah, your intuition is essentially correct. It's not developed where we are. Southeastern Montana is rural. There's no other way to put it. The area where we collect geographically is a very complex terrain of badlands that extends for tens of miles. It's a wonderful area to behold. And so the paleontological resources there are extraordinarily high, and that's simply by virtue of erosion of the badland topography. The fossil-bearing rocks extend underneath the prairie level, and we will never see those, you know, unless there's another ice age. So there is a lot of productive exposure at the surface already that will keep us going for centuries, I'd say.
Wow.
There's, you know, it's, I'm not sure if people really understand just how rich the American West is in terms of fossil resources. And that's not just where we are. I mean, you know, all the way down to Texas and beyond. This is, you know, scientifically very important and will keep science going for a long time, or at least our corner of it. In terms of Wisconsin, unfortunately, the last, you know, the ice ages basically removed all the young rock. That included Mesozoic rock, rocks deposited during the age of dinosaurs. We do know that in the southwestern part of the state, down near Fort McCoy, there are exposures of Cretaceous age. That's rough. That includes the age of T-Rex that we're collecting. We don't know exactly how old those rocks are. And we also know that some fossils have been found. But those exposures are on Fort McCoy, which is a military area, and I think they test munitions there. They open it to hunters, I think, in the fall, and it's always been in the back of our minds.
But you don't mean fossil hunters, I suppose.
Right, yeah, deer, that sort of thing, yeah. And that's been on our radar for some time. We haven't moved on it yet, and I think, you know, realistically, our expectations are restrained. So fossils are places where you've had the circumstances for fossils to be preserved, bones to be preserved, but you also need the exposure at the surface, and that's produced by later erosion, and actually glaciations are really quite helpful with that. They're not required, but it's contributed to what we see in Montana.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, we have with us in the studios today Dr. Thomas Carr, who is the director of the Center for Paleontology at Carthage College, and with him Megan Zeitz, who's been the preparator for the paleontology program for some years. Megan, what year did you come to Carthage?
I started in 2011.
Oh, okay. So happy fifth anniversary then, I guess.
Thank you, yes.
Describe how large an area that we're talking about that the Carthage Paleontology Department has access to And then within however large a space that is, how much of it have you had the opportunity to work on?
So our field area is several square miles, and it seems a lot bigger than that when you're on the ground because you can't go anywhere in a straight line. It's back and forth. It's up and down. It's up and down some more. So it's a lot for us to cover, and over the past few years, just dependent on weather conditions and road conditions, we've been in all different parts of our field area. So last year we were quite a bit more to the east. This year we concentrated more to the west. And each year we might only do a relatively small proportion of our field area. Mm. But over the years we've covered quite a lot of it.
Right. So describe, first of all, how lengthy a typical dig is and how similar each day within that time frame is to all the days that surround it.
Okay. So typically a field season is 4 weeks. Dr. Carr and I are out there for the entire 4 weeks. Most people join us for a week or two, sometimes three or four. We had several people last year stay with us for most or all of the season. And then day to day, it's fairly standard. Weather permitting. We always have to say weather permitting, but we rise fairly early to get out while it's still relatively cool. And we are looking for fossils. We are going to establish sites where we know there are fossils. And you might spend perhaps your morning sitting and digging out a large bone. And then perhaps towards afternoon, when you start to get antsy and need something different to do, then you might spend more time walking around either nearby or going out to a completely new, unexplored area and hoping to find things on the surface, maybe something poking out of a hillside that might merit digging in further and maybe find a whole new dinosaur that way. It does happen. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to stay out rather late this year. We had good weather almost the entire season. It was really nice that way this year. And then we have a little bit of time for relaxing in the evening. And sometimes we even go out later at night when it's nice and cool again. That's a really good time to just walk around and look for things.
Hmm. So is everybody in exactly the same place, or are different people doing different things? And who decides who's doing what?
So our program has grown since we first began. It used to be we'd have 4 or 5 people out at a time. Now we have 15 to 20, typically. So that's very much a good thing, but of course it means a lot more organizing on our parts. And since there's 2 of us, that makes it a lot easier. We pretty much always divide it up. The beginning of the season, we stuck together a lot more because we were trying to figure out what shape the dig this year was going to take. But once we figured that out, we'd typically divide up. Dr. Carr would take a group to one site. I'd go to another one. We had a field assistant this year. He would take yet a third group to a site. And then depending on how close those sites are to each other, we might not see another group the entire day, or maybe we'd meet up at noon to go hike around. So it depended a little.
Wow. So Dr. Carr, before this even began, for instance, this year's dig, what kinds of things were you thinking about in terms of, I think Megan described it as sort of the shape of the dig, or you know, kind of the master plan of how it's all going to unfold? I mean, what kinds of things even go into your thinking in terms of designing before you've even begun?
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Priority number one.
Yeah, we had... When Dr. Seitz and I put together the field report, we have to catalog all the fossils from the previous field season. And more often than not, people will bring back bits and pieces of fossils that we've never seen from new localities. And we had a couple of localities where people brought back fragments of T-Rex.
So they don't always know what they have when they bring it back, and we might not find out until later when we have a chance to look through it all.
Yeah, so it's something, but in the moment, it's not certain. None of you know for certain what it is.
Well, it's we just don't see the fossils.
Right.
With 15 people, we can't see everything.
Right.
Yeah, it's such a huge volume. It's that productive, and we can't look at everything. We try and look at as much as we can. People will, if they find something particularly intriguing, they'll show us. But we had a couple bags where out spilled out fragments of T-Rex. And so those become the top priority localities to investigate. It turned out that that one of the Rexes, the H&A Rex, they had the volunteers who found those fragments. Turned out it was just the last gasp of a weathered bone, but the beauty of it was that it was just opposite what's called a microsite, which is a little layer of rock where there's a huge accumulation of scales and bones and teeth. And so we stayed at the locality with the students and volunteers. The students focused on seeing if there was more of the T-Rex bone. There wasn't. But in the meantime, the volunteers were picking up mammal jaws, dinosaur teeth, fish scales. Mm. So it was part of a larger deposit that gave us a much more accurate picture, a snapshot of the Hell Creek Formation at that moment in time in that particular spot. The other T-Rex fragments were also part of another microsite, and so they didn't go anywhere, but we had to investigate just in case. So in addition to that, we do have a backlog of dinosaur skeletons in the ground. They're mostly Triceratops. And so we'll apply for quarry permits, they're called. And we have those in our back pocket. And we prioritize those dinosaurs based on where we can reach in terms of just getting out into the field and what the logistics are. So there's a couple of layers of consideration to make. But we go out with a general idea of what we're going to do. So we never go out and just search blindly. We're actually quite systematic about it.
For those of you just joining us, we have in the studios Dr. Thomas Carr, Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage and Director of Carthage's Center for Paleontology. And Dr. Megan Zeitz is with us as well. She is the preparator for the program and does essential work Dr. Zeitz, why don't you explain a little bit more about what's behind that intriguing term of preparator?
Sure. So a fossil preparator is taking care of the fossils. It might be cleaning them. It might be putting a thin consolidant in to help stabilize them. It might be putting them back together after they've been broken in the ground by erosion and those kind of natural processes. So I spend a lot of my time doing that. And then I'm also the field assistant. So I'm going out to Montana helping out with this large crew that we have out in the field and just anything else that might come up in our paleo world. Mm-hmm. We're doing some research. We're trying to get data together now that we have this database of fossils that we've been working on for the past 10 years. And so I've been putting a lot of that together as well.
So is your work as a preparator mostly done or entirely done back here at Carthage in the Straws Science Center, or even out in Montana, is some of what you do there, this kind of preparatory work?
We do start out in Montana. We bring some of the glues out with us to the field and do some initial work to make sure everything gets home as safely as possible. And then most of the work happens back in Kenosha. I have a lab at the Dinosaur Discovery Museum down in the basement, so I don't actually have a presence in Straws at all. But we'd like to expand outward. I do come over to Straws every now and then to use some of the microscopes for photography. We're trying to put together a field guide, and that's been essential to get photographs of some of these tiny fossils and tiny features that we would like to see in the guide. So I do spend a lot of time over there for that purpose. As far as doing preparation work in the field, my motto is usually just to do the minimum we need to get it back home safely, because I can only look for fossils in Montana. I can clean them in Kenosha. I can't look for fossils in Kenosha, not dinosaur fossils.
Right, exactly. So that belongs on a bumper sticker. That's a good saying. Very good. One thing, speaking of bumper stickers, one thing we have not yet talked about is something that you say was really quite transformative for this particular dinosaur dig, namely the fact that for the first time you had access to three ATVs, all-terrain vehicles. Mm-hmm. Dr. Carr, you were kind of lamenting the fact that it took you 10 years to figure this out, but of course it wasn't exactly as simple as that. But yeah. Tell us the story of how how this came to be possible this year and what a difference it's made.
Yeah, we've The primary vehicles we have are vans, and those are pretty limited in terms of their reach onto the Jeep trails on the ranches. And we'd push the vans as far as we could go, but we discovered that they're truly limited. And it was a rude awakening for 2015. We had some pretty high expectations, but the vehicles just couldn't get anywhere. And it was a suggestion of one of the ranchers that we actually rent ATVs. And I'm laughing because she could see very clearly the amount of time that we were losing just to hiking around. You know, it would take us hours to hike from our main base camp that we'd established, take hours to get back, and we just lose a lot of time and just simply to that. And so we took on the suggestion. We got permission from our BLM manager that we could actually do this, take ATVs out, stay on the Jeep trails, not deviate. And it all worked out in the end. It, combined with that, we rented a lodge. So we actually rent the old family house on a ranch. And that became our home base. No more setting up camp, no more hauling water. We had running water and electricity. And just logistically and in terms of morale, it just turned everything around. So we'd, you know, head out to exposure at 7 a.m. We'd get there within an hour. We could spend all day. Normally, we would have to quit at noon or 1 of exhaustion in the old days from hiking out and then lose the entire afternoon and maybe then go out to exposure in the evening. But we'd be out till 4, 5, or 6. You know, we could push ourselves as long as we wanted. And then we'd just drive back and still have energy in the evening. And people would be able to make dinner and enjoy dinner and get up the next morning energized and ready to go. It was truly, I think, yeah, transformative is the appropriate word for that.
Wow. So not only saved an extraordinary amount of time, but also energy.
Yeah, energy, resources, and it actually, the ranchers have been tremendously supportive, and so they would help haul fossils out, like the big field jackets, and we didn't have to interrupt their busy work. We had the vehicles. We could do all of that ourselves. So it actually lightened the burden on the ranchers, even though they seemed very happy to help us. Just as a matter of conscience, I'd rather be doing that all ourselves so they don't have to bother. We don't have to pull them off their important ranch duties. So it really worked out all the way around, and there's no going back to the old ways. It really changed everything. We have a sort of a central group of return volunteers. We're extraordinarily lucky to have them come back from summer to summer, and they really noticed the difference. I mean, we could tell that it had changed the experience for them as well. Of course, the new people just wouldn't notice, but it really, I think, advanced things for us across several fronts.
Right. So where is it that you stay every night, and that's an hour away from where the dig is? That's an hour's drive from the dig? Am I understanding that correctly?
So we stay in the old homestead of the ranch. The family's grown. There's several generations now, so there's two additional houses. The old original house is usually rented out to hunters in the fall, and so it's available, and we rent that, and so it's a house, you know. It's in terms of sleeping, it's a dorm arrangement, so everyone's piled into the living room and adjacent and rooms attached to that. There's a kitchen. There's only one bathroom with a shower, so we work out a schedule for sort of use of the house and the house rules, and it works marvelously.
Right. Now, before that, you had more of a base camp that was...
Yeah, literally tents, you know, personal tents, two huge safari tents, one for just socializing, so to escape the heat of the day, and then a kitchen tent. And more often than not, when it comes to tents, southeastern Montana will not suffer a tent on the ground. And so about halfway through 2015 field season, Montana destroyed the safari tents.
Mm. Really, really destroyed them. Picked one of them up and blew it away.
Wow. Now that's a wind.
And snapped the metal poles and everything. So I just realized that, we can't do this anymore. We need a new approach because this is just a tremendous waste of time and money.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand what necessitated you staying so far from where you were digging.
Where we established camp, when we did camp, we would camp as close to exposure as we could get. And so that meant that we wouldn't have to, come in from, say, the ranch every day.
Right.
So, and that did work well for many years. It's just, but now we can, have all the creature comforts at the lodge, and the ATVs are fast enough that we can just zip out. In about an hour, we can be anywhere we want, and the return trip is just an hour. So we only lose 2 hours to just transit time, and the rest of the day, is out on exposure, getting things done. So in previous years, we were prepared to put in that commitment of time and effort to establish a camp because we could camp right next to exposure. So we would camp just down slope of the little Clint locality in previous years, but it's just become logistically too unmanageable,
right?
Because the vehicle issue, and just we're extending our reach,
right?
And so we have to go further and further away from our original base camps.
And this allows that to happen.
Absolutely.
Dr. Zeitz, you were mentioning that one thing that happens in these dinosaur digs, and I suppose it happens more and more as more and more of you are participating in these digs, is that you get to the end of a dig and there has not been time to sufficiently or completely process certain remains. Talk for a moment about the work that you do with those kind of specimens that you, in effect, can't remove and take with you at that moment in time.
So usually within the last couple of days or even the last week of our field season, we've kind of realized what we can realistically accomplish and what we're going to have to leave undone for that year. We certainly hope not to leave anything undone, but reality happens, and we do sometimes have to leave something in the ground. So what we'll typically do once we've decided what's staying is that we will put some of the glues on the surface of any exposed bone, do the best we can to keep it together throughout the rest of the year, and then we'll put on what's called a winter jacket. So normally to take out a bone, we're going to put pieces of burlap dipped in wet plaster, and that makes a cast, just like on your broken arm or broken leg. And we do sort of the same thing for anything we're going to leave in the ground, so it has a nice solid cap on any exposed surfaces. Try to keep it together, keep it in place in the ground where it's safest. We'll put that on that, let that dry, and then we'll put a tarp on top of that and cover that with dirt. And what that is serving is that it's insulating it from the wind and the rain and the temperature extremes. It also helps combat erosion just by gravity and everything like that. A lot of our sites are found on hillsides, so we don't want anything falling down the hill in our absence. And it also keeps the site covered up so that it's not visible to people who might be coming by.
Right, just the casual onlooker who might disturb it in an
unfortunate
way.
Right, we don't want any signpost that says dig here for dinosaur bones.
Exactly.
We avoid that.
Right. Well, one of the things you were describing to me before we went on the air was how this was, first of all, a very, very fruitful dig overall, that you were in essentially brand new areas, I think, right? And so you are finding all kinds of, just in general, finding all kinds of exciting things. And then it all climaxes on what turned out to be kind of a final triumphant day when maybe the single most exciting discovery of the dig was made. Describe what happened.
You can correct me if I'm wrong. About halfway through, our field assistant, Steve Hobie, a Carthage alumnus. Quarter of the way through, he was driving his vehicle just by some exposure. He was, I think, coming to join my group, and he spotted some bone weathering out uphill. So he was in motion, driving by, and prospecting while driving. And he's...
Skills.
Yes. And that discovery led to about a half-sized Triceratops skull. So we're talking animal between 15 and 20 feet long, beautifully preserved skull. It had drifted apart like our Triceratops Maddie, an adult that we collected over the past several summers. And, even a small Triceratops is no small affair in terms of collection. And the field jacket that contained the horns was several hundred pounds, several feet across. And we removed that jacket, meaning flipped it over, capped it, and then slid it down the hill onto a side-by-side, an ATV, at the 11th hour. It was all said and done at 10:30 p.m.
Wow.
On our last night. And I was determined to get that. We had been rained out for the whole day because it started raining at 3 a.m. and didn't stop till 10. Oof. So we had to wait for the ground to dry, and we didn't get out there till sundown. And so it was this tremendous, epic effort on the part of our crew to just see this through to the end. Because just the thought of leaving those fossils out all winter, just no one could accept, and we did it.
Wow.
So it was a very triumphant evening.
Yeah. And you said that this is not the first time,
right,
that this is it's not by design, although in some ways if you're going to write a script for a dinosaur dig,
yep,
it's kind of a cool way for things to proceed, but it has nothing to do with the way you want it to go.
It's just the way it happens. Yeah, it's in a perfect world everything would be done on the second last day, and then the last day would just be spent backfilling quarries. We actually had to backfill quarries by law. When you dig a big hole in the ground, you have to fill it back up as best as you can. And so we actually had to stay back for the morning of the next day that we intended to leave very early. So we had to just shove our schedule back by a few hours into the next day. And it all worked out. We have to have that sort of flexibility, not only in terms of our schedule, but mentally. We cannot be rigid in our thinking, or else, that just adds undue stress on what otherwise can operate quite smoothly. And so I think we manage that angle quite well. So we could tolerate that slight change in the schedule. We went through the same thing the previous year. Maddie was an 11th hour retrieval. We had the assistance from the ranchers that evening, and it all worked out. I'm happy to say.
Wow. Something else that was different about this year, aside from the fact that you had access to these all-terrain vehicles, was the fact that there were a couple of outsiders that were on hand with you on this dig. Tell us who those people were.
We have, I guess, to set this up, our science, vertebrate paleontology, is in a crisis, sort of a global crisis, in that dinosaur fossils are exploited commercially. They're literally poached from areas like Mongolia. They're poached from federal lands in the United States. Fossils on private land, on occasion, or more, it's non-random, are exploited by commercial interests. So fossils are sold out of science into private hands. And fossils are information, they're data. And we're hemorrhaging fossils left, right, and center. And I'm quite outspoken about this. I've been interviewed by other outlets whenever there's this issue flares up. A couple years ago, there was an auction of a couple dinosaurs, including a Tyrannosaur from Montana, the so-called dueling dinosaurs, and I was reached quite frequently about why that's an issue for our science and why such incredible fossils shouldn't be available on the open market. So I'm quite outspoken about this in the media, on my own blog, and my Twitter account. These are issues that are I commonly discuss. And so we had a couple of people, a screenwriter and an investigative reporter, who are concerned about this issue as well. And they wanted to see what a real scientific excavation, an expedition was like for their respective projects. I don't want to disclose too much about their work since it's in progress. But I can say that there's the investigative reporter is interested in sort of the conflict between science and commercial, and the screenwriter is developing a show or that has these issues front and center as well. And so they bring a lot to the crew. I think they take a great interest in what we're doing, and reciprocally we're very interested in what they're interested in. And so it generates a lot of very interesting discussions between ourselves, volunteers, students, and them. I think it's very healthy.
So it was positive to have them there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you can easily imagine it not being, I mean, if it was the wrong screenwriter or the wrong reporter, I mean, kind of snooping around in the wrong kind of ways or being underfoot, it sounds like they knew exactly how to handle this well, and you welcomed their presence consequently.
Yes, they actually dug with us.
Hand them a shovel, and it was very physical digging, especially the first week or so we were there. And the investigative reporter was there at that time, and he pitched right in with all the rest of us.
Wow. Glad to hear it. I'm sure that made a difference.
Yeah, it was a very positive experience. People were quite, people want to know what we do, how we do things, and we're also interested in what they notice about what we're doing. And
fresh eyes, different perspective. It's really good to have that kind of thing.
So it's good for you, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we get to see things through their eyes because they've both reached out to various people in the scientific community, and so they come in with information that they have. They may have spoken to people about these issues that we haven't spoken to, and it's refreshing. In some ways you can kind of get stuck in your own way of viewing things, and so just to have their input, to hear what other people have said, to see what the commonalities are and what fresh perspectives there might be, is always beneficial.
Very good. Sounds like an exciting addition to the mix. Dr. Zeitz, for you, a lot of your work begins in earnest, as you were saying, once you're back from Montana. I remember from at least one previous conversation that we were talking about something of a backlog with which you were having to contend. I mean, that as these digs grow in terms of scope and number of people on the ground doing this work, it means the work you have to do just, I should think, multiplies exponentially, maybe. What sort of task is ahead of you in terms of processing and preparing all of that's been found in Montana?
Yes, so as along with the backlog of fossils in Montana, as you said, we have a backlog of fossils just that we've brought back. I'm only one person, and I have a lot of other things to do, not just cleaning bones day after day. So we do try to keep up. We have kind of a priority list, just as with the sites we want to investigate in Montana. Usually once we get back, I know anything wrecks we brought back, clean that first. Anything that we don't know what it is often a good candidate to clean first. Not something that's we don't know what it is because it's so broken, but something we don't know what it is because maybe the side that would tell us what it is covered with dirt. So I'll try to clean that first. Mm. But working under those constraints, that still means there are a lot of things that just can't get done right away. So we do have fossils dating back to our first season, but that's partly because those are the things that are much, much lower on the priority list, so I usually do a few things from each season and then just work my way backwards. Try to get to everything. We do have volunteers who come into the lab, both students and community members, who come and learn fossil preparation, and they're a great asset to us.
Wow. Well, so that work goes on and on and on and on. So in about the minute or so that remains, what is your sense of what will be happening the next time you're out in Montana?
Right. We weren't intending to go back out for a 2017 season, but since we have the last bit of Steve's shindig trike, we have to go back and get the last part of that skull. There's also a partial, or there's also a Triceratops skeleton at the surface in one of our new areas. There's three bones at the surface that are eroding quite badly, so we have to get those. There's another shoulder blade of a dinosaur as a stone's throw away from that, different animal. So we have to go back for 2 weeks for a sort of a rescue mission for those particularly vulnerable resources. So we'll be back, but just for a couple weeks this time.
So a shorter trip? Will it be the same number of people joining you?
That would be great, yeah.
The more the merrier.
As many as we can fit in the house.
Yep, and in the side-by-sides. So we can take carry 15, rather. And, you know, the sooner we can get sort of the field jacketing done on those big bones, then we have more eyes on the ground looking for new things.
So if people are intrigued and fancy the possibility of somehow being part of this, how can they get more information about that?
Just email me.
Okay.
Just get in touch. If people are interested in volunteering, they should know that it's very physical work. There is a lot of hiking. It can get very hot out there. It's overall a very enjoyable, productive experience. I think people are very satisfied because they, you know, see things to completion more often than not. So they can just get in touch with me. I can provide, you know, information to let them know a little bit more about it than what I've said. So they can just get in touch. All they have to do is get themselves to Montana and bring some spending money for nights in town, and we take care of the rest.
Very good. Dr. Thomas Carr is director of the Center for Paleontology at Carthage College. Dr. Megan Seitz is the preparator. And it's been great, once again, to speak with both of you about the exciting and interesting work that you're doing. And we wish you well and many more exciting discoveries on these digs as things go forward into a second decade. And thank you again for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, sports writer Costia Kennedy. Two different interviews, one about Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, the other about the physical risks involved in high school football. Support for The Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly